Okay, so the final piece in this jigsaw is essentially using what we've heard today and looking at community theatre's the future. And the chair of this final session is the current artistic director of the Battersea Arts Centre, down in SW8, I think, is that right?
11.
Oh. SW11, all right, the trendier bit of Battersea. He was also the chief executive between 2008 and 2012, and he is also the chair of Cornwall's Kneelift Theatre. And he feels that. Is that fair?
Almost close. I'm
state director. Oh, knee high. I'm thinking of knee lift because I'm an ex-athlete, you see. And high knee lift, as a la Usain Bolt, gives you that speed endurance. Do you understand? Post 2012. Anyway, let me welcome on stage, and he's right here, David Jones. David, please.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, I'm actually not chair of Knee High Theatre anymore either.
Oh, right.
But it's cool. Thanks for the introduction. I was chair of that company between about 2007 and 2013, and an amazing company they are too. I'm now chair of something called the London Theatre Consortium, which is 13 off Western venues. So, as Henry says, I'm our state director of Battersea Arts Centre. I'm not going to talk about Battersea Arts Centre today, because we're here in this final session to talk about community theatres of the future. And we've got three fabulous panellists, Sheena Wrigley, the Chief Executive of West Yorkshire Playhouse, Councillor Philip Thompson from Saltburn Arts. If anyone's wondering where Saltburn are, but you may have read about it. It's the pier, wasn't it? The pier in Saltburn with all the knitted figures. I don't know if people read about that in 2012, but it was a fantastic secret initiative. And Deborah Bestwick, MBE, Director of Oval House. And we want to look and explore with you what's the future for community theatres. I'm just going to kick this session off just by reading two quick things, which I guess, for me, perhaps pull out some of the themes that have come out of today. And it's very quick, and then I'm going to hand over to Sheena. So, I don't know if everybody got this, but did everybody get this fantastic 1945 Plan for Arts Centres document as part of this? No, it was reading for some of the panellists. So if you haven't ever read this document, I would thoroughly encourage you getting it. It's a 1945 document, and it's a description of a plan for art centres across the country. One bit says, there are three main components in this art centre, and each is planned to function independently or in combination with the others. They can be arranged in a variety of ways to suit varying sites, as can be seen from the diagrams on pages 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 and 18. One, a hall to seat 600 with stage, property store, paint shop, studio, dressing rooms and storerooms. Two, an exhibition or lecture room with adjoining reading or committee rooms with stores. Three, a restaurant to seat 200 with bar, service counter, kitchen, storerooms, wash-up and staff rooms. Then I'm just going to read you something then that was written about 20 years later by artist Joan Littlewood and architect Cedric Price. Many of you will know about their fun... I think I'm going to need some new batteries on this, probably. Many of you will know about their Fun Palaces initiative, the rather glorious idea that every town, city and village in this country would have something called a Fun Palace. And this was their description of a Fun Palace, which I think is an interesting comparison to that 45 document. Choose what you want to do, or watch somebody else do it. Learn how to handle tools, paint, babies, machinery, or just listen to your favourite tune. Dance, talk, or be lifted up to where you can see how other people make things work. Sit out over space with a drink and tune into what's happening elsewhere in the city. Try starting a riot, or beginning a painting, or just lie back and stare at the sky. And I just think that in terms of today, what I've heard, I don't know about you guys, but sitting out there and listening to what I've heard panellists talk about is far more of the latter than of the former. It's far more of the values of what it is to pull a group of people together. And having been to this conference probably about 3 years ago and listened to what I felt at the time was lots of fascinating presentations, but very... Well, how can I describe it? Kit-heavy presentations, stylistically presented about fantastic buildings with spaces and kit and extraordinary buildings. I kind of feel like today I've heard amazing stories of imagination, of chutzpah, of innovation, of people making things happening, of painting the undersides of the staircases, people who are actually really passionately going about doing what they do. So I feel like somehow that spirit of Joan Littlewood and spirit of the Fun Palace is very much in the air, certainly of what I've heard today. So I'm going to introduce our first speaker now. We're very lucky to have Sheena Wrigley, who's Chief Executive of West Yorkshire Bay. Please put your hands together.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to use the lectern because otherwise I think there'll be a sort of paper and technology crash going on. The beginning of the day, Peter said, you sometimes need to look back in order to look forward. So I'm just going to look back a little bit at the organisation that I work with. We started 5 years ago on a major programme of change for the West Yorkshire Playhouse. For those of you who don't know, the West Yorkshire Playhouse is another theatre in the city, down at the bottom of the hill. It came into its current incarnation in 1990, and we'll have a look at some of the architectural legacy of that in a minute. We started off working around a principle of opening up and opening out our organisation. And that was really about looking at ways that we could re-engage with communities that we serve, but also looking at ways that we could revitalise our artistic and creative activities. And through this time, we've been looking at the notion of community theatre and how that is reflected both in the activities that we do and create and offer, and also, most lately, in the physical design and functionality of the theatre that we live in. The beginning of this story is quite important because the Playhouse, as we know it, was started, came out of a campaign by local people to found a producing theatre, or a repertory theatre as it was known then, in the city of Leeds. And this campaign went on for many years, and eventually the Leeds Playhouse was founded in a school and a sort of university gym up on the Leeds University site. The Leeds Playhouse lived there for 25 years, all of that time looking for an opportunity to move itself into the city centre, really with a deep conviction that a theatre for the city needed to be sited somewhere in the midst of the city and near to the communities that it was there to serve. This is Quarry Hill, which is our current site, and this is what was there before we were. This is a major European-inspired housing development. That's what it looked like in its reality, and it was an incredible utopian dream which came out of the movement for new housing, people within the back-to-back housing in the centre of Leeds. That lasted 40 years and was demolished in 1978. And when the Quarry Hill flats, which were both much revered and much criticised, were finally demolished, the land that they sat on, sitting just outside the inner ring road, was low cost and therefore absolutely ripe for the development of a cultural quarter. The plan was to build an entire cultural quarter out on Quarry Hill. As it happens, what they built initially was the West Yorkshire Playhouse. This is the site here. You can see we're sitting at the moment off to the right-hand side as you're, right-hand side as you're looking at it. We are the large block. I need a pointer, I haven't got one. Large block here, and this is the city centre here. This is the area that's going to be a cultural quarter, and as you'll see when I start talking about the particular challenges we face now and the way we're responding to them, this cultural development never actually happened. The beginnings are important for another reason as well, because they enshrine the belief and the ethos of the West Yorkshire Playhouse as it became once it moved to that site. And that's what it looked like and still does look like. And in a sense, the theatre, its first mission statement, which contained lines about transforming people's lives through the power of theatre, is very much the basis on which we operate today. It also struck me as I was thinking about this that that mission statement in itself was not very far from probably the mission with which the town planners envisaged the Quarry Hill flats that were originally on the site. The original building was conceived to reflect this community ethos, and if we have a quick scan through what the current design principles, you'll see that that's typified. Firstly, I'll just get that one, it didn't look like a theatre. The idea being that it would be inviting, it would be sort of approachable and unintimidating. The auditoria, of which there are two, a large auditoria of 750 and a small auditoria of 350 and 400, are single space auditoria. There's very little, there's no bad seats, there's no cheap seats. It's big sweep, it's democratic, it's the Greek amphitheatre style. Everything was made on one site. So the workshops, the production side of the theatre was based right on the same site as the theatre, the sense of craftsmanship and industry happening. And the big, I suppose, the big signifier for the building is that it has these very, very large public spaces, which are, were conceived to be and are still incredibly democratic spaces when they are full and when they are bustling. From its earliest incarnations, this community vision was translated into action through a broad range of outreach, education, community and learning programmes. The theatre under the leadership of Judy Kelly was very much renowned for this, and many of the early initiatives actually are still part of the core programme today. Carnival Messiah, huge community production, which has been mounted two or three times subsequently, remains a landmark. Heydays is an ongoing club for over 55s, which happens every single week, 400 people take over the building. That's been going for as long as the theatre's been standing there nearly. As the beautiful Octopus Club, which is a biannual club night for people with learning disabilities and their carers and families, which is well attended, not on the site, I have to say. And work with young people, which over the years has flexed and changed, but always been a present part of the theatre's activities and artistic programme. Over time, though, so having said that, I think that the ethos of the theatre did continue to be about community and about engagement. Over time, perceptions began to change. When I was thinking about this presentation, I was going to say that I was thinking about the comments that people feedback to us about the building, and I realised that the sort of things people say about the building were actually very similar to the kind of comments that I was hearing when I was first appointed to my current post just over 5 years ago. There were comments about the organisation and the building being invisible, somehow being closed off and insular, having its back to the city, perhaps not being porous, not often being criticised for being insular and not generous and open with its facilities and its expertise, and its largesse, really. So when we set out to look at how we wanted to change the Playhouse, the questions we asked ourselves were, what would make this a 21st century theatre? What would make it, what would be the characteristics of it as a 21st century, vital, relevant, community-orientated theatre? And the vision that we've come up for with it works across twin principles of extraordinary, compelling, and relevant art, but always with a sense of specificity to place, a sensitivity to community, and a sense of rootedness in both the locality and the social purpose of the communities we serve. So we started with three basic tenets in terms of defining our community theatre, both physical and in terms of activity. And one was actually about the building. And somebody asked this morning about whether there was a sort of tension between the physical bricks and mortar and the artistic activity. And I absolutely side on the same opinion as I think Neil Darlison from the Arts Council and Corey Thiari from CAST, points they made, which is that these things are synergists. They should work together. We want the building because it is bricks and mortar and it provides a gathering space and a democratic space where people can mix, can come together, can be creative, can be antagonistic towards each other. And one of the greatest joys in the Playhouse is seeing people in the big open spaces from completely different backgrounds and completely different shows and productions, mixing together, contending with each other, being in that single big space. So we want a building that's open from early morning till evening, that's active and lively. We want something that you can feel welcome in and you can see into, and that feels porous and rich and has a validity not only as an artistic building, but as a social centre, as a business centre, and as a learning space, all simultaneously. Inside that building, we then come to turn our attention to the activities. We've started talking about ourselves as a company to try and differentiate or make more specific our activities as a group of creative people within the building. And we're talking a lot about how we open up and strengthen our links with another community, which we have perhaps in the past not connected with as fully as we could have done. And that's with a local artistic community. That's about being a creative hub and being a place of creative activity for artists who are emerging in this city and this region, who want opportunity in this city and this region, and giving generously and democratically of the things that we do have, which are spaces and expertise, and to some degree, even with government cuts and so on and so forth, some of our resource. We also have recommitted ourselves to strands of work which have a very specific and local accent, to work which combines local stories with professional performance, with community performance. Productions like The Hounding of David Oluwale, a play which we did about 4 years ago, which is based on a very specific local story relevant to Leeds. This is a production of Nine, which was done by Chris Good, and which uses local people's stories and local performers in a very professionally supported production as part of our Transform Festival. This is a picture of Transform, which is a sort of new area of our work where we're looking at opportunities to develop more cutting-edge work, more developmental work. And it's this area and areas that support it, our scratch nights, our playground, our work in development, our subletting of our, or we didn't sublet, our giving away of space to emergent artists and companies, just helped us to start to develop this new sense of community around the building. First floor is in a different building. We have three buildings. This is the second of our buildings. This is a specific centre for working with young people, and specifically working with young people who are from quite challenged backgrounds. So the work here is very highly supported through a very high level of pastoral care. It's not a youth theatre or a kind of unsupported intervention. It's very much it's done in partnership with agencies within the city. We do have a youth theatre now, but I have to say that's very recent, which we have in the main building and which fills a lot of spaces a lot of the time now. And Community Network, which is a long-standing initiative which builds relationships with communities that don't necessarily have access to mainstream theatre or find that access particularly easy. There's an entire engagement strategy which we've begun working on, and one element of that is also about getting us out from beyond our own walls. This concept of porosity, us moving, other people have spoken about it today, us taking us our own work beyond the walls of our theatre, but also looking at what it takes to bring people back through the walls with us so that they are able to own and shape the theatre that we are becoming. There are some challenges. I think if I can just dwell on those for a couple of seconds, there is an issue of conflict, I think, in the way that we're being extolled to become more commercially viable, particularly those of us running sort of slightly larger organisations, at the same time as continue to develop our engagement and deepen our engagement at a time when public funding is to be less of our income maker. The pressure to earn more money, to work with individuals rather than with public bodies to generate the underpinning funding for our theatre is causing us some tensions, and I think that's important to note. So what we're going to do with the building as an articulation, if you like, of where we're heading creatively. This is some of the things people said to us. This is what we look like now. I'm going to have to rush because I think Mr. David's standing there looking at me. The fact that it didn't look like a theatre actually became a major problem for us. In terms of looking at the new building, what we're trying to attempt to do with it, I'm going to give you a snapshot of designs by DLG architects, or architects we're working with in Leeds here. This is not a funded scheme, but what we wanted to do was to find a physicalisation of this idea of opening out and opening up the organisation. And we wanted to connect the theatre to the major developments that are happening in the city centre. There's a huge redevelopment of the city centre going on about to commence now, right in front of where the theatre is, which makes the first part of this very, very important for us. We wanted to make the theatre special and visible, so it's a place you wanted to come to. I think one of the things that's hampered us is that the desire to make it look unimposing has in many ways made it look very, very bureaucratic. People don't actually know it's there or know it's a theatre. So the big thing is that we turn the theatre around so that it faces the city. So that in future it will face this way and have entrances in and out. Essentially, this is about building an entire new frontage to the theatre whilst maintaining all of the back entrances as well. So in a sense it acts as a bridge between the older residential communities and the regenerated city centre. It creates passages between both. and we think that's both metaphoric and physically part of what we're there to do. We also make it porous, so there are no high windows, there are no brick walls, everything is glass, you can see into it. Inside, all the walls are taken down, and you can see into spaces, you can see what people are doing. We can open it up in ways that at the moment are not possible. We want to maintain and build on those big democratic public spaces, but we also want to be able to make them more human in scale when that's required, so that we can bring those in and bring those out, and section off areas so we can make a more fluid use of the building, more performances, more impromptu activities in those public spaces, not only in the theatre design spaces. And the final element is that we want to, there's more outdoor space, lots of in and out, something up for the building, and there is a new creative space, which is important to us because it allows us to offer space to local artists, to youth, to expand our youth work and our communities. This building may never get funded in this form, but I think it is an important physicalisation of a journey that we've been making. And even if we're not able to realise in its complete form, we feel that elements of this will be woven into our future.
Thank you. It feels very wrong to cut somebody off when they're in their hometown. And you're cool, OK, we're going to move on to Councillor Philip Thompson, who's going to talk to us about Saltburn Arts.
Sorry,
okay.
I'm so sorry, I've lost the last slide.
Philip. Thank you very much. You may have noticed that I'm a man, but I'm not the lady who's meant to be on the programme. I just apologise for Wilma's absence. Her husband needs 24-hour care, so she thought it was appropriate for her to be at home. So we wish her well and may her husband. For some reason, I've got two mics. I don't know what that didn't say. My remit is to speak for only 8 minutes and to cover five topics. And they are an introduction to Saltburn Arts, the inspirational story behind the winning People's Millions, the difference between new equipment and seating that will make, the advice to arts and community-based groups considered on taking on community assets, and the role and challenges facing groups such as myself and yourself. So here we go. Saltburn Arts is the shortened name of Saltburn Community and Arts, and the building, which you now see in front of you, was constructed in 1910. And this is a building designed by Baines Architects of London. It's a primitive Methodist church. In 1969, the congregation was too small to make it viable, so in 1970, the local urban district acquired it. And since then, a local drama group has spent 40 years trying to turn it into a theatre. And it's been reasonably successful, because you see the outside and then the inside. It's a proscenium theatre, it's got 149 seats. And we have been fortunate enough to be able to have a community association that is now a registered charity and is also a company limited by guarantee. I can digress just very briefly because funding came up this morning and some things that were not said, but if you're a registered charity, you can get 80% off your rates. If you're a registered charity, you can apply for gift aid and increase your revenue by 25%. If you're a registered charity, you should only pay 5% VAT on your utility bill. So if you don't know about that, please make note now. So, People's Millions. You may have heard of People's Millions. It's a big lottery grant that is awarded, in our case, in the region in Saltburn, which is a very small town of some 6,000 population on the northeast coast of Scotland. No, Yorkshire. See, I keep going home. North Yorkshire. And Tyne Tees Television produced this annually. So for 4 nights, two applicant groups vie with each other to promote their project. And last year, the Saltburn Community and Arts Association wanted to improve its facilities in the theatre. It has refurbished seats, refurbished in 97, with the support of the Theatre Trust, which previously were chapel bench seats. but they have not lasted with the usage because we've had lots of throughput. So one of the aspirations was to get funding for new CJ. The £50,000 award that was achieved came because people had to telephone in and vote. So how do you get people to telephone in and vote to win enough votes? And that comes back to community involvement and about the community theatre. Now, the drama group has been in existence for 60 years. So during that time, it's had an affinity with the community. So they were more than ready to pick up the mobile phone or look up the landline if they still got one and dial 10 times, which you're allowed to. And that ensured that Saltburn Community Arts won the £50,000. How is it going to be spent? It's going to be spent on new seating, as I've said. But it's also going to be spent on new sound equipment. Now you might think, well, hang on, sound equipment in a theatre, what's the point of that? Can't people speak anymore? Can't they project? Well, it's a sign of the times, because we can't rely anymore on amateur drama being the main focus of theatre. We've heard about commercialisation, how we need to get funds coming in. We have stand-up comedy. We have visiting groups, and they're all wiped up. They require amplification. Why? We may question. But without that, without that, they won't come. So part of this grant is going to be applied to install new sound equipment. We already have a cinema. 10 years ago, we thought that this was an area that we ought to invest in. But the sound for the cinema isn't necessarily as good as it should be. And we have audiences that are getting older. So this new sound equipment will also help to be multi-purpose in that respect. Now, I come on to advice to arts and community-based groups considering taking on community assets. Do we pontificate at this point? What would I say? If one was going to consider acquiring a community asset, I would have to say, what is the benefit to the community of doing so? And really think that through. It isn't simply enough to say there's a building there that's deteriorating and we'd love to have that as part of our heritage retained. But unless it has a function, and unless it can provide for the community, there is little point in getting concerned and organising a community asset transfer. One should have a group that's properly constituted. That is of vital importance. So if you can be a registered charity, if you can be a company limited by guarantee, for example, these are sort of fundamental key points that you should look at, because governance is of the essence. Will there be enough qualified trustees? And we've heard earlier about continuity. Who's going to replace? Do we stay on? Do we stay on too long? Should we have gone before? So we need to think about renewing. New blood, we talk about it, but it's difficult to actually engineer. And then fourthly, is there a sustainable, viable business plan? Because without that, all these ideas, these aspirations, mean nothing. 4 or 5 years down the road, we're back to square one. So you've really got to do your homework. So, the future, the role and challenges of facing groups such as yourself, that's me presumably included. We've had various conflicting views this morning about telling people what they should have. But I do think we need leadership. Without being advised what is out there, how are we to know? If we don't know about history, how can we learn? So we do need to respect people with knowledge, as long as they use it for the benefit of the community. So we need leadership. We also need to be listeners. We can't dictate all the time. We can't be promoters of concepts. So we've got to listen. And not just pay lip service with our ears, but genuinely recognise that everybody in this theatre, everybody outside the theatre, has a view, and we should value that. We also need to be facilitators. Because even though we've got ideas and you've got ideas, how do we articulate them into a plan? So you need to be able, perhaps not learned, perhaps not too experienced, but have a concept and an understanding that you've got to link in ideas and human beings so that you can translate that and facilitate that. And fourthly, I think we need to ensure that we consult. There are many generations who attend theatre. There are some generations who have never attended theatre. Perhaps that's because they are ignorant of theatre. And ignorant means not knowing of. So it's a job, isn't it, that we all share in promoting information. And that can come out of consultation. So consultation, I feel, is really important. Now, I feel, Mr. Interlocutor, as I stand here, that I'm sort of pontificating a bit, but I just want to try and emphasise the specific points that I think are of great importance in what we are going to do collectively in the future. Now, local authorities were mentioned. Local authorities are represented by elected members, officers we've heard of, but they don't know everything. Some of them allegedly know nothing. But we've got to respect each individual. Some of them haven't had the benefit of the wisdom that we've heard earlier, speakers who've been around the world and have had open eyes and listened, and they've learned. We should learn from their experience as well. Now, two more points. We need to have a continuity of dialogue. So we haven't just gone out for consultation, have we? We've got all the boxes ticked and that's the job done. We need to continue to think about what is the future, evolution. What does that mean? Something we're all part of, is it not? So, buildings, are they the raison d'etre of theatre? No, they're not. Buildings allow the facilitation of drama and performance inside. But we haven't spoken much about outside, have we? There are open spaces. There is an opportunity to perform drama in the open air. So local authorities also have open spaces, and we should be guarding them as much as we should buildings, because open air theatre is very much, in my mind, an important contribution to make. And finally, I'd just like to mention amateur drama groups. Many amateur drama groups don't have a home. And some of the homes that they have, we were ashamed to be in. But they still perform, despite all the odds. So one of the assistances that we could, looking forward, give is to share our assets and invite other drama groups to come and perform, as well as in their own venues, in ours, so that they can get the opportunity to share in that, to explore new audiences. So, Mr. Chairman, these are some ideas about how we might look forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Philip. We're going to now hand over to Deborah Bestwick, Director of Oval House.
Hello, good afternoon. I am Deborah from Oval House, so that's me. Oval House, we never did. I don't know why I'm talking about the future of community theatre. We never describe ourselves as a community theatre. However, we have a very strong relationship with our community. Our theatre is based on our relationship with the community quite often. And I think that's because we believe that for theatre to be... Is my mic on? Is it? Yeah. For theatre, all theatre, to be meaningful, it must have a relationship with absolutely every group within our community, within our society, and within our world. And so, to that end, theatre at Oval House has always been a matter of unlikely alliances, which is really the basis of true diversity. And... Right. Help! Oh, I know, now I've pressed that bit. Yes. And here we have, you see, here we have the roots of Oval House, which is an unlikely alliance between the graduates, the hallowed, the privileged graduates and undergraduates of the hallowed halls of Christ Church in Oxford, running a philanthropic mission in Kennington, and generally running a boys' club and taking them on camping weekends and building balsa wood aeroplanes. And you can't see this very well, but it's a report by the Ministry of Education, and it took them 4 days to report into Oval House in 1958. And they said, much credit is due to the warden, for that's what artistic directors were called in those days, for his energy and the stimulus which is given to the boys' club, where creditable standards of attainment are achieved. Older boys' disability, a development which is hoped will gradually become an outstanding feature of the club. And that's something that I think, you know, we still try to live out today with our current community, with our art, with our up-and-coming early career artists, and with the young people in South London. Now, this photograph marks, I mean, never let it be said that a presentation about Oval House would not include gratuitous nudity. This is Peter Oliver, who was the warden at Oval House.
Deborah, what was the production?
The production was Pip Simmons' theatre company. He's in the dressing room. He is performing in Andy Music, which will mean something to lots of you. Now, when he transformed Oval House into a theatre, believing that the performing and particularly participatory arts were a good way of empowering young people, he also was not afraid to bring in an eruption of, you know, the most experimental early, and at that stage, early career radical artists. And so there he is, unafraid to appear in a photograph, preparing for his role in Andy Music. And he transformed Oval House into a theatre by choosing to extend the boys' club's activities by rehearsing them in a production of A Taste of Honey in 1968 and taking that to a boys' youth club festival. You know, right there that was A Taste of Honey in those days, and understand its impact. Here is our building. That's still our building. That door is currently a fire escape. But his transformation of Oval House led to generations of new waves of radical artists. That's a picture of Tim Roth, who was then in our youth theatre sometime in the 1970s. He was a local youth at a school called Dick Shepherd, now demolished. It was so reviled and feared. He was a pupil there. He joined the Oval House Youth Theatre. He did his training in theatre. He did his first professional performances there. Again, following through that ethic. And here is one of our current young people. She's actually in our workshop for young people with complex multiple disabilities. Some of our artists carrying on. I mean, within that group, there are artists who were part of our counterculture 50 years season. So an artist who'd been imprisoned in Malawi for writing a novel about homosexuality, appearing in the same bill as artists who regularly appear at Ducky from the Royal Victoria Tavern, which is one of London's foremost gay queer venues. And all of the time, a dialogue with audiences, making theatre which is meaningful to audiences, supporting artists who have a local resonance, a regional impact, and an international reputation, and going on tour. So, our building's too small for us. It doesn't work for us financially. We're subject to financial shock because it costs us ever more to run, and we've exploited every possible angle of getting money in. Added to which, we're on a dusty corner. I've always felt that our spiritual home is a mile and a half down the road. Brixton has always been characterised, actually, by its creativity, from the different waves of communities who gathered there, made their lives there, and established themselves through culture. Nowadays, it's always been home to a high ratio of artists because of cheap housing, squats, etc., etc. tremendous history, very well established community. And I've been trying to move into central Brixton for about 15 years. In the last couple of those years, it's been changing. This was one of the original covered markets, now transformed into trendy restaurants. You'll see Jay Rayner reviewing them quite often in his column in The Guardian. So tremendous local support. But nevertheless, gentrification. And it doesn't always go down well. And that's the key thing that our community is dealing with. That's the opening of Foxton's last year. Yucca's out. And yet, it's a community living with the kinds of things that nobody ought to have to live with. High indices of deprivation, overcrowding, street crime, etc., etc. And people do recognise that change needs to happen. And that's one of the arches close to the site we're going to, and the graffiti on it says, gentrify me. So it's an interesting tension. And ever since I spoke to the Brixton Business Forum 10 years ago and said, we would like to move Oval House into Brixton, the first person, and I thought, oh, people might be a bit, because, you know, those of you who live in these environments will know that the first symptom of a community under pressure is to have a go at each other. And I actually thought that people might be, well, why do we need a theatre? How much is that going to cost? What's it going to cost to support you? We don't need that. And the first people to stand up and say, that's exactly what we need, was Stuart Horwood, chair of the Street Markets Federation. And here he is, last year, running, in fact, working in partnership with Barbie Asante's company, Hope and Magnet, showing people around the markets and talking about the market traders in initiatives to bring the arts into their working environment. And so we started a feasibility. Now, I've been through hundreds and hundreds of feasibilities. We're now on the cusp of one that's actually going to work.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for your faith. Keep it going. This is a schematic. It's a massing diagram from the feasibility. It's not a designed drawing. And it's a feasibility that for Oval House we did in partnership with architects Foster Wilson. We've had tremendous support from our local council. And I think that comes out of the democracy of a whole community saying, yes, that's exactly what we need. We own the freehold on our site up at the Oval, and that will go into the ownership of Lambeth Council. They will develop it, and in return, they will put the full developed value of our old site into our new building. They will give us the land on a 999-year lease at a peppercorn rent. The building next to it is a mansion block of some historic importance with a mural on it that sort of crystallises for the Brixton community the whole sort of squatting and radical political movements in Brixton. So that's staying. That's staying. The community have cried out for that. The whole thing is a partnership with a community-led development of homes, other enterprise initiatives, health centre, etc., etc. And that's a true partnership between Brixton Green, a community organisation, Oval House, and the council. And the community have fed into this all the way along. It suits Oval House because it's not a traditional developer-led initiative. The council will retain the freehold of the land, and they will retain the equity of the housing, but they will turn it over for management to a third-party cooperative who will manage it for 30 years. The council themselves are borrowing the money on a prudential model to fund this whole thing. Then the cooperative will manage it and pay the money back. This enables Lambeth Council to provide 40% of the homes of this on target rent. That's council rent. But the third, and the rest will be on what Boris is now calling cap rent, this, that, and the other rent. But the council will maintain the equity. There will be no homes sold off. There will be no right to buy. The homes will stay owned by their democratic community, the council. What are we going to have in our building? We're going to have our two theatres, which are available for youth used by young people and up-and-coming artists. We're going to have 7 rehearsal spaces, which will contribute to, I hope, theatre companies performing all over London. We're going to have a minimum of 16 work units for other creative and arts organisations who will pay us rent and keep us going. That is the future. It's a business plan, it's an ideological plan, and it's an operations plan. And it works for us on all those 3 levels. Why are we doing it? Well, that's Reuben. He was in our youth theatre when that picture was taken, doing a project. The rest of his T-shirt, it says, actually says, "Give me a voice, not a label." And it was taken during the year, it was taken during 2011, when much of Brixton was on fire again. And our youth did pop-up performances, sort of establishing themselves as positive members of their community, that young people were not to be feared or reviled. And here they are, taking to the streets on the first anniversary of those riots in Brixton. They themselves, the young people, devised a project called One Day, and they did pop-up performances. Actually, they danced on buses, on the platforms on buses. They just got on buses and danced. They did choreographed dances all the way up walkways on estates. They did dance pieces on the skate park in Brixton. And that's the Brixton Cinema in Brixton, that's the Tate Library. And I think for me, the future of community theatre is that young people and artists will take the streets when it is important and address issues through art. Back to Reuben, that's what it's for. Give me a voice. The future of community theatre.